And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have something very special today for folks who love movies, and especially folks who love great movies of a certain era. The book in hand is called The Last Decade of Cinema by Scott Ryan. It is a book which focuses on the great films that were made in the 1990s. And it is Scott Ryan's contention that the 1990s were, in a sense, the final heyday of great cinema. And through a combination of various factors, films, at least in general, have never quite been the same, nor the way we consume film. That has also changed drastically in many ways, which in turn has had a profound effect on the kind of movies that get made. Scott Ryan is someone who has studied film, thought a lot about film, and written very persuasively about film and television. And among his various books includes Moonlighting and Oral History. I had the pleasure of speaking with him about that. Also a book about the great TV series 30-something, another book called The Last Days of Letterman, The Final 6 Weeks, which I've not yet had the chance to read and look forward to exploring sometime. But again, this latest book is called The Last Decade of Cinema, in which he not only kind of discusses in general the way in which the movie-making business has changed so dramatically over the last few years, but then takes the time to examine in fairly thorough fashion and thoughtful fashion a number of great films from the 1990s, at least two films from each of the years of that important decade. It's a book that I really enjoyed start to finish, and I'm excited to talk with him about it. The book published by TuckerDSPress.com. Scott Ryan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Ah, thank you so much for having me. And I got to say that when I was listening to you say what I say about the 90s, I was thinking, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, that's right. It's my theory. No wonder I agree.
Exactly. Well, I really appreciate all that you explore in this book. I really, really do. I wonder if we could just, first of all, take a little longer view and kind of talk about your own relationship with film, with going to movies. And it's something that you touch on in the book's introduction in particular. But share with our listeners, in a sense, your lifelong love of movies. I guess it's a love of movies that in some respects is met with some great frustration as the movie industry has changed in recent years. But kind of give us a sense of how it all began for you.
Well, when I started to really and truly look at film as art was when I got a job at a video store in Little Massillon, Ohio. It was called Video Time. It was a mom and pop video store. They had like 4 locations in the city, and I could take home any movie I wanted for free. And so you watched the new movies, which were great, but I also went back and watched movies from the 40s and the 60s and 70s. I was 20 years old. I was in college, and it really opened my mind to what film could do. At the same time, we were coming out of the 80s where all the movies were happy ending, moralistic type movies. You know, the bad guy was going to get punished, the couple was going to get together, and everything was going to be fine. In the 90s, Quentin Tarantino and Spike Lee and Paul Thomas Anderson and Richard Linklater and all of these people were coming up, and they were changing movies, and I was right there at the front line, you know, just having my mind opened by this. I didn't realize how lucky I was until, you know, that faded away.
Tell us about some of the observations you make about what it was like for the typical person to view a movie back then. And it's so interesting to kind of think about it. I mean, for somebody like me, born in 1960, I vividly remember what you are writing about here. But for somebody of a certain age, they might not really understand just what the world was like once upon a time in terms of if you wanted to see a movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating because I always find it so intriguing how we're sold whatever new technology comes down. And we're always sold that it makes everything better. And it might make some things easier, but it doesn't always make things better. In the 90s, when you wanted to see a movie, you got in your car, you drove, you went to a video store, and you walked up and down aisles. You looked at movies. You picked them up, you held them, maybe you read the back, you saw who directed it. Oh, Julia Roberts is in this. I like Pretty Woman. Maybe I like something to talk about. And they were all there. You have Star Trek sitting right next to Star Wars. Now, how does it work now? You're sitting on your couch, and you pull up one streaming service, and they only have the movies they make or that they have a contract with. And they're pushing those movies on you from some algorithm that none of us understand. And I don't know, to me, that active part of getting up, getting in the car, going to get it, driving home, that movie better be worth it. And they were worth it. And I feel like overall, that's like a psychological difference that we're going through now, where it's just on your TV, and as soon as it's over, it says next episode, watch this immediately, then I'm going to let you watch the credits. And so nobody's thinking about movies. They're not thinking about them while they're watching them, and no one's thinking about them when they're making them.
Yeah, that was an especially interesting observation I thought you make, that in a sense, in so much of what we take in, we just aren't allowing it to penetrate us in the same way. I mean, we just don't tend to experience anything in terms of entertainment as deeply, in part because we're sitting in our living rooms, and chances are we have our phone right there, and the dog is barking, and the doorbell might be ringing or whatever. But to be fully immersed in a film, that is an experience that fewer and fewer people have, less and less. And you're talking about a time when just about always that's how you experienced the film.
And the person making the film knew that, especially in the 90s when audiences were demanding something that was complex. And now they're making something so you can also do something else while you watch it. And I have so many friends that tell me, like, oh, yeah, I got to work all day, but I'm just going to watch some movies while I'm working. And you're like, what? Like, try to put on Eyes Wide Shut and do something else and then understand what's going on in that film. Like, I mean, I was afraid to write about it, and I was sitting there watching it as intently as I could. Because it's complex and it's difficult and it's challenging and it makes you uncomfortable. And that's another big thing that I love about 90s films, is they purposefully put you in uncomfortable positions, you know, emotionally or thought-provokingly. And then you got to think about how you feel about it, or think about what I would do in this situation, or if my kid was in that situation. And that helps us connect with strangers and empathize.
Hmm. Speaking of strangers, I appreciated another observation you made in your introduction. You've already touched on the first matter, but then it's the second that I really want to talk about for a moment. You said, back in the day, there used to be a very good reason to go see a movie. The hope that you might just have a deeply personal moment while being surrounded by hundreds of strangers. This is also something that either some people have very seldom experienced in their lives, if at all, if you're of a certain age. And even for some of us old enough to have had that experience plenty of times, it's amazing how quickly you can sort of forget what that experience is like, to be in a darkened movie theater with people you do not know watching the same film. Explain why you think that once upon a time was a very important aspect of experiencing film on a more profound level.
Well, there are a couple of movies that jump out to me. One is The Prince of Tides, which is directed by Barbara Streisand. It stars Nick Nolte and Barbara. And it's a drama, no doubt, and covers some really heady topics. But it's also super funny. There are scenes that have just great one-liners. Now, if you're watching that at home, you might laugh, but you might not laugh as hard as when a whole audience laughs. And then you're like, oh, that was a funny cut, or they really got me there. And so your emotions go up. So when the drama comes in and the movie gets serious, and now all those people that were laughing, you hear them sniffling or the in and out of their breath, because there's a lot of silence used in that movie as well. And I will never forget in the big scene of that movie when you find out Nick Nolte's secret from his childhood, I could hear every person breathing. And you're having this moment together. And I think that bonding is, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to be too highfalutin, but I honestly believe it's what keeps us as a community together, because we all have these experiences. And, you know, I don't know, can you really get that because you watched it and then tweeted emoji, a little picture thing of an eggplant to someone that explains the movie? I don't know. It meant so much to me, and it shaped me as a writer and an author.
Hmm. As you talk about that, I am reminded of a powerful movie-going moment for me. This was actually in the mid-1980s with the film Places in the Heart that earned actress Sally Field her second Best Actress Oscar. And there is a really powerful moment in that film in which she's trying to keep her family together after her husband's accidental and tragic death. And she is assisted in harvesting the cotton crop by a black man who sadly ends up being threatened and ultimately savagely assaulted by some white racists. And there is this moment when that has not yet happened, but he is just sort of sitting there innocently, and then suddenly in the doorway, I believe it's somebody robed as though part of the Ku Klux Klan, standing in the doorway. And I will never forget the sound of probably 50 of us in that movie theater, our collective intake of breath, you know, that gasp of realization and horror of what is likely about to befall this gentle character we've fallen in love with on the screen. And, you know, one might experience that in one way if you're just sitting on your couch at home by yourself, even sitting with your wife or husband or whatever. But to be, as you know, describe it, in a theater full of strangers, experiencing that moment together, collectively, that is an incredibly powerful experience that I think is something that not everybody has had the privilege to experience.
I love that story so much. Thanks for sharing that. I love it because, let's say there were 50 people in there. We know for certain that there was at least one racist person out of the 50. I mean, probably more, but let's just say. And that person just got reflected to themselves, and they heard how the other people reacted to it. And, you know, they could have still left and been closed-minded. But maybe you got inside their bubble. And the problem we're having now is there's no way to get inside that guy's bubble. A movie that I single out that kind of has this a little bit is Unforgiven. Because Unforgiven is directed by Clint Eastwood. And Clint Eastwood is, you know, pretty public about being a Republican, and that connects to being part of believing guns should be flowing and freeing, and that's our American right. In that movie, there's a sheriff that bans all guns, played by Gene Hackman. And it's just a plot point. It's a plot point to say that, you know, there won't be guns in town for the people, so they have to bring people from outside. But if Clint Eastwood made that movie today, the NRA would go after him in a second. Because they would say that means he thinks there should be no guns. And these are the things that happen. So there's a lot of politics in 90s movies, but it wasn't political. It was story. We never connected it to the actor. But it also let us experience, if I'm on this side, I'm going to see that side. And I may not like it. It may not change me, but I'm forced to see it. Now we live in a time where we know what people's politics are ahead of time, and we're either only going to see their films, or they don't get anywhere near it because no one wants to touch it. So now you don't have anything that reflects our society. And those are some of the movies that I was drawn to write about, because it doesn't have to change your mind, and it also doesn't mean you have to agree, but you get to see that story play out, and it's just a story, and we're okay. The movie ends, and you can go back to your life.
You write that you believe that the 90s was the last decade of cinema for adults who wanted to think, feel, and be positively impacted by stories told through light and sound. We're talking with Scott Ryan about his new book, The Last Decade of Cinema. The title refers to the 1990s, and he ultimately explores in some detail some of the great films from that particular decade. I want to take a moment to have you talk about some of your discussion of technology, particularly when it comes to this particular decade of cinema, the 1990s. And you talk at one point about, in a sense, the balance of storytelling and technology. Talk for a moment about the way in which you think this balance worked in a particular way in this decade of cinema.
Well, when I sort of came up with this idea, I didn't want people to think that I was saying the movies from the 70s were no good. I mean, I don't feel that way. I like movies from all the decades. But what I really noticed was in the 90s, you had really strong storytelling with a nice collision of where we are with technology. And so as if you wanted to have dinosaurs in your story, it wasn't a guy in a rubber suit playing a dinosaur. You know, they really could make credible-looking dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. Also, the cinematographers really knew how to use the camera. All the films were shot on 35 millimeters, so they were beautiful. We knew how to score films. You know, when you watch a movie from the 40s, it might have a great story, a great character, but if a bad guy walks in, they're going to play bum, 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 bum. And, you know, it feels old. In the 90s, they sort of matched perfectly. Now, what happens after the 90s is technology takes over, and then it's all about special effects, and they've gone too far, and story hasn't quite kept up with it, with the technology side. It doesn't mean there aren't some good stories now, but are they getting lost in, you know, more digital characters and all of that? When I see a movie and you see, like, I think Evita is a good example, which is a 90s movie with Madonna playing, you know, it's the famous musical. There's a scene where they're at the balcony and she sings Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, a very big, famous part of a movie. Those are all real human beings standing out there. That's not a computer that just popped them in. Now when they make a movie and you have this huge army fighting, it's all computer and it takes me out of it. To me, there's something about that they had to get people in those big crowd scenes. So they could do some technology, but not all.
So for you, the balance is just about perfect when we're in this particular decade, the 1990s. And after that, as you said, technology begins to, in a sense, tilt the balance and, in a sense, grab way too much of the spotlight to the detriment of the overall quality of movie making.
Correct. And I back that up with, you know, some statistics and facts that sort of show it. It isn't just me saying this. I wanted to find some proof of it as well. And also in the interviews that I conducted with people who were working then and are still working now. Hmm.
Something else you touch on when it comes to the matter of technology is that once upon a time, films were on film. In your words, shot on glorious 35 millimeter. And you say, more importantly, they were screened in 35 millimeter. I think this is a point that would be lost on, first of all, a whole generation of younger moviegoers. But for even some of the rest of us, we might not be fully aware of, in a sense, what we're missing out on, what has been lost with the shift from 35 millimeter film to completely digital projection. In your mind, what is the loss, the detriment that is most significant?
I think the first thing is the feel of it and the imperfection. And I'm not above this. You know, I didn't really notice it happening while it was happening because I was still going to see movies in the early 2000s when this was really occurring. And then I just sort of forgot about it. You get used to watching a DVD at home. And I feel like also in the 90s, yes, there was VHS that you could rent, but we were all saying, well, this one I got to see in the theater. And nobody was saying because it was shot on 35 millimeter, but that's really what it was. When you went to the theater, you got this experience because the picture was just beautiful. And everyone was at the top of their game because they had been working, you know, it had always been shot on 35 millimeters since the beginning of time. So you have all this knowledge. And then what happened is in 1999, George Lucas released Phantom Menace, and which is shot on 35 millimeter, but he decided that the sequel to that, Attack of the Clones, would be digital. And he told theaters you could only screen it if you screened it in digital with a digital projector. Well, what theater didn't want to have a Star Wars movie? So they all switched over to digital. And once that happened, people wanted to have another digital movie. I just spent all this money on this digital projector, so give me something else. And that's sort of what happened. And what you lose from that is just this little bit of humanity. And what happens when light shoots through film and projects it up on this screen? and the way the colors are. I mean, yes, it can look perfect at home. It can sound perfect at home. But what you're giving up is the feel. And I think the best comparison is the difference between listening to an MP3 that's been compressed and streamed through your phone and putting on a vinyl record and listening to it. There is a humanity difference to it.
Mm. You write, what you see today in a movie theater is all digital projection. Every screening is exactly the same and devoid of the human element. The same thing happened with vinyl records when CDs were released. Everyone told us it was better because it was perfect. They were wrong about music, and they were wrong about movies. Perfection does not mean better. I wonder if you would mind telling our listeners a story that you tell about going to a screening at a movie theater that I remember going to when I lived in Chicago, the historic Music Box Theater on the north side of the city. And you presided over a special screening there, and you experienced something that was pretty powerful for you.
Yeah, I'm very much involved in the world of Twin Peaks, which is directed by David Lynch, and I get to go to a lot of David Lynch film fests. And I even have a book on the film, Fire Walk With Me. And they were showing that movie, which I've seen more times than a human should have seen it. But when I'm sitting in the theater, I heard that of the movie theater or the projector, the film is actually going through. And there's also a strobe scene in that movie. And man, those lights, they hit you so much when it's strobing in and out. Like, you really feel it. And it was like I'd never seen the movie before. And it was incredible for me. And that's really when I realized we'd been sold on something that wasn't true. Now, we're not going to have a 35-millimeter thing in our home. So, of course, try to make it as best you can on Blu-ray, and those things happen. But I think theaters made a mistake in saying you can only get this here. And there are some theaters that are doing this. Quentin Tarantino bought the New Beverly Cinema in Los Angeles, and I've seen a couple films there. And it's sold out every night. So people actually do want this. And I'm hoping that, you know, people like Tarantino, Spielberg, Scorsese, they should be putting their money into buying theaters across the country and getting people reinterested in 35mm. Because when you see a movie in it, especially one you've seen a bunch of times at home, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just as vinyl has made a comeback that I think a whole lot of people never imagined in their wildest dreams would occur, who knows what might be possible in the world of cinema. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Scott Ryan, and we're talking about his most recent book called The Last Decade of Cinema. And the decade that we are talking about is the 1990s. By the way, I think you make a really good point also in your book's introduction that we probably have to be careful when it comes to something as relatively arbitrary as a decade. I mean, that's, you know, kind of a human construct, and very little neatly fits into the space of a precise decade. But that being said, it seems like this particular decade does work pretty darn well. Can you just talk a moment about that matter of decades and how things do not magically switch on and off, you know, right at the onset of a decade and just as a decade is ending?
Yeah, I mean, it is strange how it feels that way. But, of course, it can't really be true. And I definitely point out that, like, in the beginning, one of the first movies I cover is Pretty Woman. And there's a lot of 80s in that movie because, of course, it was written in the 80s. And a lot of it is in reflection to what was going on with the stock market and the movie Wall Street and Ronald Reagan's presidency. I mean, all of that is is peppered through Pretty Woman. But the seeds are sort of there with that film. That's why I only cover two films there. But as we go along through the decade, I started covering three because we're really getting more into the 90s. And then, like a lot of people said to me, are you going to cover High Fidelity in your book? That movie's so wonderful. Well, that movie actually came out in 2000. And I mean, it could be in there because it has the sense of a 90s movie. Also, the movie Almost Famous came out in 2000. So it's not like when the, you know, 99 switches, this just stopped. It doesn't work that way. There's a little bit of a carryover. You can kind of see it as the decade goes on. One of the things I looked at that I didn't put in the book was about the summer movies of the 90s. In the beginning, there was all kinds of different films in the top five for the summer. But honestly, by the end of the decade, it's like all kids movies. So, you know, it's starting to happen in the 90s, but I still stand behind. The thing that works really well is that they chucked 35 millimeter after 1999, between 99 and 2002. So that's how I think I can win the argument of the 90s really was the last decade of cinema because, you know, what? In fact, I actually found an article that they didn't know what they were going to call the Star Wars movie if it was digital. They were like, can it even be up for an Oscar? Which I think is funny because they thought, is it even film if it's not shot on film?
So let's talk about kind of the core of this book in which you examine particular films from the 1990s, and not necessarily your very favorite films from this decade, but films that you found yourself moved to write. First of all, I think it'd be really interesting for our listeners to hear about the kind of involved process by which you ultimately whittled down a long, long list of possibilities to the films that you ultimately explore. Tell our listeners about that kind of intricate process.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of crazy how I picked these movies. I mean, in some ways I tried to be scientific, and on the other way it's like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Like, it makes no sense. But my idea was to first make a list of just movies that I remembered, because I didn't want this to be a book about the most independent, small art house type films, which the 90s thrived in that. And that could be another book. But I was more interested in what was playing at the local mall. I wanted to talk about things that everyone could see and was in every video store across the country. So I came up with a list of 160 movies. And I watched those. So it's not like it happened overnight. It took me about 4 years to work on this book while I was doing other things. Just every weekend, I was watching 90s movies. And then from there, if I could say something about the movie, it got moved into, you know, like a higher list. Because there were movies that I enjoyed, but I thought if I sat down to write about it, I might just be like, it's funny. It's good. Like, there's nothing to say. I mean, there had to be a moment that you were like, whoa, that could never happen today. A movie like The Birdcage, which stars Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. You know, it's really funny. It's a great movie, directed by Mike Nichols, who is one of the best directors of all time. But during the time I was doing this was when Tennessee was passing the law that you couldn't have drag clubs anymore. And so you're watching this movie made from the 90s that, you know, was a huge success, not just with a small audience, with everyone. Everyone loved that movie in the 90s. And basically the whole thing is set in a drag club, and that would be illegal in the time I'm living in. And I'm like, that is so fascinating that we're living in a time where we're losing rights as Americans, which I'm not sure has ever happened before, maybe since Prohibition, but I don't know if alcohol was a right. But so that's a movie to write about. Like, that's sort of how I did it. I mean, there's so many other movies I could have covered, but did the movie say something, and did they take a chance, and did no one really think of it as a chance? Because I don't remember feeling that way when I saw a movie, like, whoa, this was brave. Mm. That's actually what you expected from a movie.
Right. So in a sense, in the moment, these are films that were not especially daring in the sense of the filmmakers taking a risk. I mean, not that it, in a sense, wasn't a let's say, a commercial risk, but that was just intrinsic to the business back then. I mean, it kind of went without saying. Right. Every movie you made was a risk, and that was part of the whole business. And now, of course, by and large, the major studios are completely risk averse. And that means we are basically seeing films that, by and large, play it very safe.
Yeah, and if no one's taking a risk, if I'm not risking upsetting you with my art, then I'm also not going to reach someone else who's going to inspire them. And that is the thing. Like, this movie inspired me, all of them, at one time or another. And they made me, you know, want to be a better person. And it's not, again, about morality, because you could have a movie like Pulp Fiction that has no good people in it at all. They're all bad guys, like all of them. But the risks that Quentin takes in the way he told the story and the way the characters are developed and how we empathize with them, that made me want to take a risk in my writing and want to see something else like that. And I think that really matters. And it's not about offending people. Like, that is also, I don't know that, I'm sure people got offended just as much back then as they do now. But I don't know, there's a different feel to the way corporations are protecting themselves from art. And I don't even know if corporations should be involved in the art of it. Like, they should step aside and sell us Cheetos or a car or something, but maybe stay away from our movies.
Mm-hmm. I do want to mention that at the back of your book is Appendix 1, the list of movies. And this is the list of movies with which you began your research, and you watched a whole lot of these films. And I don't, so is this the list of 160 plus?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it's a staggering list. I mean, as we go down and you know, and there's a number of these films that you do not actually write about, but, you know, I'm just jumping around here with Misery, Awakenings, Ghost, Thelma and Louise, JFK, Fried Green Tomatoes. I'm just jumping around this long, long list. Last of the Mohicans, Philadelphia, The Piano. I'm just thinking of some of the films that I have seen and I love, and they are a minuscule part of this staggering list of films. And that really, in a nutshell, gives us a sense of the greatness of this particular decade. Explain how you did finally winnow down this long list to the list of films about which you write, and maybe touch on how difficult some of those choices ended up being.
Well, my first idea for this book was not to focus on actual films, but to focus on topics. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll have a chapter on drama, I'll have a chapter on comedy, I'll do a thing about how there was sex movies. I think I had a better title for it from sex movies, but all the, like, Michael Douglas, Disclosure, Basic Instinct, Madonna's Body of Evidence, you know, all those, I think they were called erotic thrillers, now that I'm thinking about it, which is so funny that that was a whole genre of film. And, you know, comedies, I was going to kind of do it that way. But then I was really getting caught up in some of the movies, and I thought, I didn't want to be general. I think the book works better being really specific, because then you can tell kind of a wider story. And I sometimes zoom in maybe a little too tight on certain shots and things like that. But I don't know. So that's why I had the 160. And that's why I was watching all of these at the beginning. And so then I decided, I kind of really want to write about Goodfellas. So I don't know. It was really hard, to be honest with you. Like, so many times I'd be, oh, I really want to write about this one, but I already have one here. And I sort of let them fight it out amongst themselves, which movies we're going to stand up to. Something like, I forget, I know in another interview, someone really tackled me on a film and was like, how could you not have this in? And I was like, yeah, you're right. Like, I should have. You know, you have to, at some point you got to close the gates, or otherwise you never finish a project.
Exactly.
So, I think on a different day, this book could be different always. Like, there'd be another movie. But that kind of proves my point also, I feel like, that there were that many choices.
Absolutely. And I just want to say that you end up, you know, touching on great films from each of the years of this decade. And so you explore films like Goodfellas, and The Prince of Tides, and Unforgiven, and The Shawshank Redemption, and Pulp Fiction, and the aforementioned The Birdcage, and The Cider House Rules, and Eyes Wide Shut, and so on. And I realize, as I look at this list of 25 films, I must admit to my chagrin that I have seen less than half of them. And I feel like after reading your book, I want to very much remedy that. We should also mention that your book includes some very illuminating interviews. I wonder if you could just talk about the presence of these interviews in your book, and especially why you sought out these particular people to interview.
Well, I really tried to contact just about everyone. I mean, I really wanted to, I knew it was going to be hard to get interviews. I would have loved to have an interview with Quentin Tarantino, but it's just hard to get to someone like that. To me, the most important interview was Helen Childress. She wrote Reality Bites in 1994, and that movie shaped me so much. It was the first movie made for my generation. I'm Gen X, and you know, it was sort of our generation's big chill. But it's such a fascinating thing, because I grew up in a time where they weren't marketing movies to me. Everything was marketed to my parents. So when I was a little kid, I'm watching Burt Reynolds movies, and I don't get them. But those are the movies that I watch. So I sort of grew up knowing that I wasn't going to understand everything in a movie because they weren't targeting to me. Well, Reality Bites was the first movie I ever went to see that were using my references. And that movie was written right to me. Helen and I are the same age, and the characters were my age. So I'm 24 years old, just graduating college, and I totally see my life up on screen. And I've always wanted to talk to her. So I really pushed hard to get her, and she agreed. And we had a wonderful interview. I think it's the centerpiece of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of get that feeling of what 90s films were about, because she had never written a movie before. So she's not going through some big studio thing where people are trying to dumb the movie down or change it or make it, like I just said, I wanted my book to be specific, not general. And sometimes when you make something really specific, you speak to a large group of people by doing that, which I know people think it's the other way around, but it's not. So that was great. Alexander Payne, I never thought I would get an interview with him. He's like a multi-Oscar winning writer-director, but he also was game. I think this topic sort of piqued their interest a little bit. And then Tiger Williams, who wrote Menace to Society, he was game for it. I really tried to get Amy Heckerling, who directed Clueless. I really wanted a female director in the book, and it just never worked out time-wise. And again, you got to finish a book when you can finish it. But I think it really helps the book because it's not just me saying this. You hear from people who created the exact art that I'm writing about.
Absolutely. By the way, you mentioned the film Citizen Ruth, and at some point in the book, you touch on the really sobering reality that if someone read this and thought, Citizen Ruth, this really sounds great, I want to watch this film, they might really find it difficult to find this movie and actually watch it. And I think sometimes in this world of streaming, where it kind of feels like everything and anything is streaming into our homes just for us to choose, we don't stop to realize that there are all kinds of things that are not easily accessible, some things that are not accessible at all, including truly great movies from as recently as the 1990s. That's kind of a scary thing to think about.
Yeah, and, you know, Citizen Ruth is probably the smallest picture that I picked. And, you could almost make an argument that I shouldn't have picked it to go with my topic. But that year that we're talking about, that was when independent films were totally taking over Hollywood. And so I think both films that I picked that year, which I'm not remembering at the exact moment what it is, it was just that's what was being made in that year. Swingers, Citizen Ruth, and The Birdcage from 96. Swingers was, again, a really small picture, but then it blew up in pop culture. No one's going to stream Citizen Ruth on Netflix because Netflix isn't going to, they don't want to get involved in a comedy about abortion. They're like, no, we're not doing that. And so it is sad that, you know, the rules are stricter today than they were in the 90s, which is kind of funny.
At the end of the book, you give capsule essays of some other noteworthy films from this decade, since there was no way you could touch on all of them. And I really appreciate this, that, you know, you talk about several of my very favorite films, including JFK and Glengarry Ross, Schindler's List, and a number of others. It fills out the book beautifully. The book, again, is The Last Decade of Cinema, published It is published by TuckerDSPress.com, the author, Scott Ryan. Scott Ryan, congrats on a really fascinating book. I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed speaking with you about it. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, composer Robert Grady talks about his brand new musical, Rip. Rip as in R.I.P., rest in peace. Rip the musical will be having its world premiere this coming weekend in Milwaukee. On Thursday, Linda Guy joins us to talk about the Four Seasons Gardens Club's Secret Garden Walk, which is coming up this Saturday, July 13th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., rain or shine. Five exceptional private Kenosha gardens on the tour, along with Hawthorne Hollow. And Hawthorne Hollow's T.J. Levesque will be joining us as well. And on Friday, Nick Dembski, the new director of the Racine Public Library. Partly cloudy skies today with a 20% chance of a shower or thunderstorm, a high of 80 degrees. Cloudy tonight, a 70% chance of showers and thunderstorms, especially after midnight. Overnight low of 66. Tomorrow, Wednesday, a 60% chance of showers, possibly a thunderstorm. Tomorrow's high, close to 80 degrees once again. We should have some sunshine on Thursday and Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical.